Search and Rescue. It should be run by the state. But either way, you know, we know that there are many individuals, Sarah Medini, Sean Binder. Sarah Medini is the subject of a Netflix drama, The Swimmers. She has been criminalized for doing search and rescue. This was all the way in 2019. And she wouldn't say, and Sean Binder, who we spoke to for this documentary, wouldn't say that, I don't want to speak for them, that they are smugglers. But those are the charges that they're facing. So it's really a way to take back control of search and rescue, and perhaps also remove any witnesses. But obviously, since that has happened, it would seem that this forced expulsion has become really, really common, and looks, in, you know, very much like a policy. The repetitive nature of it looks like a policy, and there's a clear time, 2020, when this really begun, and the criminalization also of humanitarian workers also begun. And that's not to say that forced expulsions didn't happen before then, but the scale is really quite is dramatically bigger.
That was BBC producer Lucille Smith speaking about the 2024 documentary Dead Calm, Killing in the Med, which has led to Greek prosecutors opening a murder investigation of, quote, unknown perpetrators. We'll link to the film. That does it for our show. Happy News Year. I'm Amy Goodman.
This is Daniela from STEM Champ. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, heated debate and round after round of voting mark the first session of Portland City Council as the members make their first big decision: who will be their council president? New laws impacting your right to repair your own stuff do not include wheelchairs. Now, disability rights advocates want to change that. And a rundown of dozens of new laws taking effect with the new year in Oregon. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 2nd, 2025. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us, and Happy New Year. On this first day of the new Portland City Council, 12 newly elected members representing four districts came together for their very first decision, electing a council president among themselves with a majority vote.
I'd like to nominate Olivia Clark from District 4.
I'd like to nominate Councillor Avalos from District 1.
Councillor Avalos is nominated.
Turns out, it was not an easy decision.
Councillor Clark.
I'm honored to be nominated for council president, and thank you to Councillor Smith. I just want to say that I'm here to serve. I'm here to unify to the best of my ability. I'm here to use my lived experience to help us meet the challenges that confront us, to fulfill the promises that the City of Portland has made to the people of Portland, and to fulfill the promise and potential of Portland. I will work to find common ground to achieve our aspirations for our districts as well as the entire city. It's really a privilege to be here at all and to serve our city in this capacity and to work with all of you.
Councillor Avalos.
Thank you so much, Councillor Green, for the nomination. I am really eager to be put up for this position because I have three main goals for the council presidency. Number one, I think it is important that in this new form of government, we establish a strong council and we ensure that the relationship with the mayor's office and the executive branch is balanced. This is something that the charter asks for. This is something the people ask for. And I think it is the council president's responsibility to deliver on that. Number two, I really want to see our districts thrive, and I want every district to have an agenda and have some wins. I think right now Portlanders are looking for that deep community representation, and I believe as council president, I can help usher those wins for each district and make sure that we are honing in on what people from each district are asking for our overall agenda. Lastly, I want to open up City Hall to the people. Again, the charter is designed to increase people's representation, voices in our city government. And I think the council president is going to have a huge responsibility in how to do that. I am somebody who has been I've been sitting in those seats that you all are for many times, and I have been frustrated at many points, feeling like there weren't easy ways to communicate what I believe my community needed on the council's agenda. And so that is something I'm extremely dedicated to, being able to understand what those barriers are and start to break those down so that this city hall is truly for the people. I feel really strongly as well, I'll end on East Portland having a voice in this new form of government as the first president.
We will now proceed to voting. Avalos?
Avalos.
Dunphy?
Thrilled to support my fellow District 1 Councillor Avalos.
We are embarking on a brand new form of government today, and we've been tasked with better representing and serving our neighborhoods and our community members. And just like our city, everybody up here in so many ways brings unique perspectives to the work. It has been my hope that we could elect a leader who can bring people together across not only the city, but across this dais. And I still believe that we can. But I don't think we're quite there yet. I hope and I suspect that with the vote I make right now, we can have a little more time to work together toward alignment. I vote Clark.
Ryan?
I want to start by thanking both of those who put their name up for the outreach, for the consistent communication you both provided. I really do. I found that very refreshing. I vote for Councillor Clark.
Boyana Lane.
I just wanted to say a little bit about how we've gotten a chance to have discussions and get to know each other a bit over the past month. And to be honest, I feel really optimistic about all of us. And I, including these two people who are putting their names, whose names are being put forth right now to be our first council president, I have optimism and I have confidence that this council's leadership is going to be able to work together. I have a lot of people say to me, you know what this group of 12 is going to need is like a good teacher to make sure people are really listening to each other. And so I think I might use my teacher voice a little bit, but I'm impressed and I'm excited. I believe us working together is what our constituents deserve.
Maria?
I won't leave you all in suspense. I'm voting for Avalos, but I did just want to say a few words about, I'm so used to calling you Candace and now I have to call you Councillor Avalos. It's strange. But I think that what Councillor Avalos has done throughout her career and her time is really take community feedback very seriously, really work with people who are the most impacted by these issues. And I have also seen her operate in spaces that are very difficult with people who have conflicting opinions. And those spaces are very difficult to navigate. And we are about to enter a federal Trump presidency. We are going to be dealing with very high tensions, a lot of big issues coming ahead for us. And I've seen Candace navigate those spaces with grace. And I have full confidence that whoever becomes our council president, I think we're going to all be there to uplift them and help them as well. But I think that Candace brings a special perspective that I think is very necessary for this moment. And I'm very proud to vote for her.
We have a tie vote. No one is elected president in this round. We'll need to repeat the procedure again. Councillor Smith.
Looking in the charter, it says if the council has a tie or vote for council president, the mayor must use his power and responsibility to break tie votes as provided in Article 4-2-401 under the duties of the mayor. And I need a legal consult to see if this counts for this vote.
I'll ask our city attorney to weigh in.
Robert Taylor, city attorney. Thank you for the question. It is very important
as well as the answer. For that reason, I have prepared an analysis, given the historic nature of the vote we are having here today. The conclusion is that on this vote to elect the council president, the charter reserves that decision solely to the 12 members who are present. The charter provides that the president and vice president are elected by the members present. The charter also explicitly provides the mayor is not a member of the council. Further, if a court were ever to analyze this issue, the court would look to the measure's history. And the measure's history includes the ballot title and the explanatory statement that were in the voter's pamphlet. The ballot title and the explanatory statement both make it clear when discussing the tiebreaker that was intended to break ties on non-emergency ordinances. That's consistent with the charter language that gives the mayor and any councilor the ability to introduce items to the council. And if there is a tie vote on those items, like a non-emergency ordinance, then the mayor may break a tie. So based on the text and the context and the history of the measure, we've concluded that the mayor is not authorized to cast a vote in the election for council president and vice president.
Thank you, City Attorney Taylor. I'm going to read for you what Chapter 2, Article 4 of the mayor's responsibilities, what that says. And I appreciate your legal opinion, but it does not reflect what's in the charter.
And after several rounds of voting, several delays, and many speeches, winner finally emerged in District 2's Elena Pertle-Guinney.
That took a little bit longer than we all thought it might. Thank you also to my colleagues, Councillors Clark and Avalos. Stepping forward in a role like this is never something someone undertakes lightly. I look forward to working with both of you. You bring amazing experience to the council.
Today marked the first official meeting of Portland's new city council and the start of a new era of city government. But how did we get here? Portland's previous form of government started more than 100 years ago. Commission-style government was all the rage at the time. There were five commissioners and the mayor elected by the whole city. Each commissioner was in charge of a different group of city bureaus decided by the mayor. But that led to a number of problems. Running a citywide election is expensive. And in Portland, it's meant that city commissioners were overwhelmingly wealthy white men from the west side of the river. And that left many Portlanders feeling ignored by their government. The commissioners' role as heads of departments also led to silos of government services and redundancies. Most U.S. cities scrapped this type of government in the 1960s. In 2022, Portland voters passed the Charter Change Amendment to overhaul this type of government. The new government is a major change for Portland, but it's a lot closer to what many other U.S. cities have. The City Council was expanded to 12 members elected from four geographic districts. City councilors have a narrower focus now, only looking at legislative issues, instead of being in charge of city bureaus like before. But since they're from particular districts, they can also do more constituent services, helping Portlanders in their district access city services. All the city bureaus are now united under the control of the city administrator, someone who is not elected. The city administrator is overseen by the mayor, who is elected by the whole city. The mayor is no longer a voting member of the council, but they can break ties if need be. A brand new year is bringing lots of new laws in Oregon. KBOO's Josh Salem has more in the story.
With the start of the new year, some two dozen bills passed by lawmakers last year took effect. The areas covered appear to be exceptionally broad. Some of the highlights include the following. Oregon became the fourth state to enact a right to repair law. It requires companies that make cell phones and other consumer electronics to offer tools and information on how to repair the devices. Previously, manufacturers only allowed a limited network of technicians to make repairs, which drove up costs. Now, independent shops and owners can fix items like phones. This may also cut down on waste, as consumers can repair their broken devices rather than buying replacements. Enforcement begins in July of 2027. Next, responding to safety concerns on public transportation, the legislature created new penalties for anyone openly using illicit drugs while riding a bus or light rail. Doing so is now a Class A misdemeanor, punishable by up to a year in jail, a stiffer penalty than what you get for simple drug possession. Lawmakers considered extending the penalties to drug use in transit centers and at bus stops, but did not follow through. It is still illegal to carry illicit drugs in those places. Videos were the subject of a lot of legislation. School districts are now allowed to install cameras on the stop arms of buses and forward footage of drivers who don't stop to police, who can then write a ticket. And school boards around the state are now required to post video or audio recordings of their regular meetings on the web within a week of the meeting. Some already offer live stream, but this makes access much broader. School districts with fewer than 50 students don't have to comply with the new requirements, and meetings that aren't public also don't have to be posted. In financial news, Senate Bill 1562 raises the maximum amount that can sit in the state's rainy day fund before lawmakers are allowed to stop paying into the fund. Under prior law, the fund had to contain enough money to cover 7.5% of the state's general fund revenues. Legislators increased that threshold to 12.5%, theoretically ensuring the state will save more going forward. The rainy day fund currently sits at about $1.7 billion and is scheduled to receive an additional $200 million in June. Finally, House Bill 4145 established criminal penalties for people who create, distribute, or access footage of animals being killed or tortured. Torturing animals, which does not include legal and licensed fishing, hunting, or trapping, was already a felony under state law. Now, disseminating, possessing, or accessing those recordings is also a misdemeanor. The U.S. Humane Society called Oregon's bill, quote, an additional tool for law enforcement to tackle these cases that might otherwise evade prosecution, end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
The new Right to Repair law in Oregon is expected to save the state's residents as much as $540 million a year. However, it does not include wheelchairs. As Isabel Charlet reports, disability advocates say there are often months-long delays for simple repairs, so they support a bill to include wheelchairs.
Oregon's Right to Repair law, which increases consumers' ability to repair their own electronics, takes effect this week. The law requires manufacturers to provide access to replacement parts, tools, manuals, as well as digital keys needed so people can fix their own devices. Charlie Fisher with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group helped author the law and says it needs to go further. That's why, along with disability justice advocates, he's pushing for wheelchairs to be included. Fisher says the current process for getting wheelchairs fixed is overly complicated and takes months.
Just simple barriers that shouldn't exist are really what we're trying to address in this wheelchair right to repair law. And it just seems like common sense.
Fisher says Democratic Senator Jeanine Solman of Hillsborough will introduce two bills this year to expand the right to repair law. One bill would add these protections for wheelchairs. The other would simplify the repair process when going through Medicaid. Wren Grabham has been working on the bills and says additions to the law would require wheelchair manufacturers to post their manuals and allow a person to fix their chair without voiding their warranty. Grabham says when she was 16, her electric wheelchair began shutting off and giving an error code. Because there is no public manual for the chair, she didn't know what the code meant or if the chair was safe to keep driving. Grabham says fixing it included getting insurance approval, so it took a long time.
And so I had to pretty much use an old chair that didn't fit me for 6 months.
Grabham says even simple routine fixes like getting a new tire or battery for her chair take months because she has to prove the new parts are needed.
Even though it's something that we could fix in a weekend, if we were able to actually get the parts to fix them.
Osberg's research finds being able to fix phones, computers, and appliances instead of buying new ones will save the average Oregon household more than $300 a year. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
California's lemon law saw some big changes starting New Year's Day, making it harder for consumers to get replacement vehicles or refunds. Suzanne Potter reports General Motors was a strong supporter of these changes.
The changes mean that instead of just taking the car to the dealer for repairs, you're now going to have to formally notify the manufacturer via email or certified mail and include your name, the vehicle ID number, a summary of the problems, and a demand for a refund or replacement. Rosemary Shahan with the nonprofit Consumers for Auto Reliability and Safety says if you don't take this step, you forgo lemon law protections.
they're going to feel like they can ignore you and refuse to fix the problem or just do a real cheap temporary band-aid fix until the warranty expires, and then they'll tell you how much they want you to pay for the repair out of your own pocket.
Governor Gavin Newsom said he signed Assembly Bill 1755 reluctantly in order to cut down on lemon law lawsuits clogging the courts. Shahan notes that lawmakers agreed to the changes only after GM and Ford threatened to support a ballot initiative capping attorneys' fees in consumer lawsuits, something vigorously opposed by consumer attorneys who are big political contributors. The governor did negotiate a new bill, soon to be introduced, that would allow manufacturers to opt in or out of the new program. Supporters of the changes, including GM, Ford, and Stellantis, are expected to opt in, while opponents such as Honda, Toyota, and Tesla may decide to uphold the old protections. Shahan notes that the new lemon law says that consumers who have negative equity, meaning they owe more on the lemon car than it is worth, can be forced to come up with the difference before the manufacturer will buy it back.
The manufacturers will say, oh, we'd be happy to buy back your lemon, but first you have to come up with whatever the negative equity is before you can give us clear title to the car. And most people can't afford to pay out of pocket, so they're going to be stuck with a lemon car.
The new lemon law also rescinds protections after 6 years, making warranties longer than that unenforceable. And consumers will now have only 1 year to file a claim, down from 4. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In-Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, 100% chance of rain tonight, down to a low of 42. Tomorrow's weather, rain continues early, then remaining cloudy with showers in the afternoon, a high around 50. Today in history, on this date in 1863, President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing the slaves in the Confederacy. The quote of the day is from Lincoln. I never in my life felt more certain that I was doing right than I do in signing this paper. If my name ever goes into history, it will be for this act, and my whole soul is in it. The authors of Project 2025 back a constitutional convention. Some Trump nominees could avoid FBI background checks, and Louisiana public schools test the separation of church and state. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2025 Talks.
There's great risk and great potential harm to everything already enshrined in our Constitution if we do open up this Pandora's box.
Jeff Foster with Common Cause Massachusetts says if 6 more state legislatures vote for a constitutional convention, Congress would have to call one, and America's founding laws would be up for grabs. Supporters say a convention's needed to cut spending, and the authors of Project 2025 have strongly endorsed the effort. But critics say even basic protections like the First Amendment might not be safe. The Senate is expected to begin confirmation hearings next week for President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet picks. Former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi has been tapped to lead the Justice Department, but she also vows retribution against its staff.
The investigators will be investigated because the deep state last term for President Trump, they were hiding in the shadows, but now they have a spotlight on them.
Bondi served as one of Trump's lawyers during his first impeachment and sought to overturn the Affordable Care Act. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, Trump's pick for Secretary of State, and his choice for UN Ambassador, Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, are expected to get bipartisan support. But the pick for defense, former Fox News host Pete Hegseth, is described by former co-workers as having a serious drinking problem and admitted to paying a woman to settle a sexual assault charge. Democratic Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth lost both legs in combat.
We're talking about an organization that is 3 million servicemen and women and civilians and a budget of over $900 billion. He does not have the experience to run an organization of that size.
The Director of Intelligence nominee, former Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard, faces quiet but intense resistance. Critics say her ties to Russia and pro-Kremlin stances make her a national security threat. Trump's transition team has agreed to allow some FBI background checks, but it's unclear if every administration pick will be vetted. Minnesota Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar says nominees for jobs like attorney general need to be fully investigated.
We require these background checks of drug enforcement agents, first-time prosecutors for the federal government. Why wouldn't we get these background checks for the most important job in the United States government?
She notes Republican senators have just enough seats to approve nominees without Democratic votes. A law that requires display of the Ten Commandments in every Louisiana classroom, kindergarten through college, takes effect this week. A group of parents are suing, saying it violates the Constitution's prohibition on government-enforced religion. But Governor Jeff Landry tells Fox News that if students don't like it, they don't have to look.
When the Supreme Court meets, the doors of the Supreme Court on the backside have the Ten Commandments. Moses faces the U.S. Speaker of the House. What's the big problem, Sandra? That's the part that I don't understand.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Outdoor recreation continues to fuel the economy, growing 36% since 2012. Now, a bill on President Joe Biden's desk could lock in protections for more public lands to support recreation. Kathleen Shannon has more on the story.
A bill that has already passed in Congress could expand opportunities for recreation on public lands. The Explore Act, presented to President Joe Biden last week, would help ensure public lands and recreational areas remain accessible and fund updates for old infrastructure, among other improvements. It comes as the outdoor recreation economy has grown 36% since 2012, according to an Outdoor Recreation Roundtable analysis. Cycling is up 11%, and Jessica Zephyrs with the Missoula-based Adventure Cycling Association says she's seen increased interest in biking off paved roads.
What we've really seen growth in are things like bike packing, gravel cycling, e-bike touring, guided tours, getting outside and experiencing nature in the world.
The Great American Rail Trail could fit the bill. Announced in 2019, it's a non-motorized trail designed so a user can cross the entire country separated from traffic. The Montana section, which will run from Yellowstone Northwest through Saltese, is 25% complete, according to the Rails to Trails Conservancy. Zephyr says new and used bike sales spiked during the pandemic when more people started recreating outside. She says it's hard to tell if they're still using those bikes as other hobbies have become available again.
The hope is that we can continue to inspire and empower people to get out on those bikes, ride in a way that is exciting and empowering for them.
One section of the Explore Act specifically supports biking on long-distance trails. New data show outdoor recreation in the U.S. generated over $1 trillion in economic output last year, or 2.3% of the nation's gross domestic product. I'm Kathleen Shannon.
Life-changing connections are coming to the Navajo Nation. Pueblo of Santa Ana gets more than $6 million to design wildlife crossings along I-25. And the Senate passed 4 out of 16 bills proposed to invest in Native communities. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
There are homes on tribal lands that still need electricity hookups, including on the Navajo Nation, where climate change makes it harder for families to keep cool. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Bradle has more.
It's a scorching hot morning in the Navajo Nation. In the foothills of Navajo Mountain, Leland Tomasio is standing outside his home, trying to catch a breeze.
We have a metal roof on top. All that heat just builds up inside, and it just cooks the place up inside.
That wasn't always the case, but Tomasio says the reservation feels hotter each year. The Tomasios are one of 13,000 families living without electricity here. That's nearly a third of the homes on the reservation, which stretches across parts of Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico. A Navajo utility nonprofit started in the late 50s to help change that, but progress has been slow since then. A land dispute with the Hopi tribe led to a development ban across 1.5 million acres for several decades. And getting a home site lease approved and accepted for electricity development can take years.
So come on in.
Yeah.
Back at the Navajo Nation, the Tomasios are standing in their kitchen. A coffee maker and microwave are on the counter. Paulette Tomasio says they've never been used.
You wish you had all these stuff in here. Oh, these are going to be on soon.
She then points at the stainless steel fridge tucked against the far wall.
Even this refrigerator, this is a fake refrigerator.
But days without a refrigerator and air conditioning are now over for the Tomasios. Their home was one of 170 on the reservation that got connected to the electric grid this year. That's thanks to a mutual aid program called Light Up Navajo that relies on private and federal funding and volunteer workers.
That just brings tears to my eyes. And then, like, every morning we get up, and I just always think to myself, I'm just waiting, waiting one day, this will come.
And now she says heat-related stresses no longer consume her. For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
This story is a production of the new radio program, Our Living Lands, a collaboration of the Mountain West News Bureau, Quantic Broadcast Corporation, and Native Public Media. More climate reporting on the program can be found at BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. The Pueblo of Santa Ana in New Mexico has received a nearly $6.4 million federal grant to improve safety between wildlife and vehicles. The U.S. Department of Transportation Federal Highway Administration award is to help the tribe design wildlife overpasses, underpasses, or other features along nearly 8 miles of highway and 19 miles of interstate. The Pueblo, located near Albuquerque and Santa Fe, is one of 16 recipients to receive funding for wildlife crossing projects nationwide. The funding is through a new grant program in its second round of awards to improve safety for motorists and wildlife by reducing vehicle collisions. According to the Transportation Department, each year more than 1 million wildlife vehicle collisions are estimated to impact motorists and wildlife in the U.S. Wildlife vehicle collisions in the Pueblos area are said to include deer, elk, antelope, bears, and mountain lions. 16 bills investing in Native communities were passed by the U.S. Senate in 2024, led by U.S. Senator Brian Schatz, according to the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. The committee's highlighting billions of dollars in investments in housing and health care and support for Native lands, tourism, water rights, and bison restoration. Four bills were enacted into law. In a statement, Schatz, who's chair of the committee, said he's proud of the progress made during the year, but said the committee has a lot more work to do for Native communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 2nd, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings, Lisa Loving, and Josh Salem. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of